This is CICK News.
Nearly 10 years after the BC toxic drug crisis public health emergency was first declared, the toxic drug crisis remains one of the most devastating public health issues in the province. Since 2016, more than 16,000 people in BC have died from unregulated drug toxicity, making it the leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 59, surpassing deaths from accidents, suicides, and homicides combined. While the crisis affects every part of the province, the impact in the north is especially severe. Northern Health continues to record some of the highest death rates in BC, according to coroner's reports, with recent figures showing rates as high as 44 deaths per 10,000 people, which is well above many other regions. Fentanyl and other increasingly toxic substances dominate the unregulated supply. And today, most deaths happen indoors, often when people are using alone, making timely intervention difficult. For northern communities, the crisis is further complicated by geography, access to services, and ongoing inequities, particularly for Indigenous people who continue to be disproportionately impacted. To talk more about what the past decade has looked like in northern BC, as well as what comes next, I spoke with Northern Health's Chief Medical Health Officer, Dr. Raquel Kling.
We're talking about 10 years of the toxic drug crisis in the province. And looking back over the past decade, what would you say that you see as the biggest shifts in the toxic drug crisis, particularly in northern BC communities compared to urban centers?
Well, I think a real shift that I've seen, regardless of where people live, is just how toxic the drug supply is. And we've seen shifts in what's contaminated in the drug supply, and things are getting more and more dangerous to people who use substances. And I think that's important to recognize and still be aware that, you know, even though we're 10 years in, that the drug supply is still incredibly toxic and causing a lot of people to die from using substances.
You kind of mentioned what I was talking about, which is that the drug supply becoming increasingly toxic, unpredictable. How has that reality changed the way that public health responds in smaller, more remote communities?
It just means we need to be aware of what's being contaminated in the drug supply, and knowing how we can best support our communities to respond to overdoses. So we know that with the types of contamination, such as benzodiazepines and their analogs, we know that it's getting increasingly difficult to reverse overdoses, that usual doses of naloxone that we used early on in the crisis aren't working anymore. We need to use more and more naloxone, making sure to use oxygen and other types of life-saving supplies that we can use. So yeah, we just need to be aware of what's happening in the toxic drug supply so we know how we can support our teams to save lives on the ground.
Are there other blind spots that you see in response to these last 10 years, or places where you feel like public health is falling short, you know, due to many reasons, demand, staffing? Obviously, you mentioned, you know, the increased toxicity of these drugs, changing nature.
Yeah, I think something, you know, especially in rural communities, you know, just making sure that we have services available for everyone that needs them, like harm reduction supplies in places where people who use substances can access them. We, like, with such a large geography, we know that it's challenging to ensure that everyone can access supplies, and we continue to work on that and expand our services and making sure we're working with communities and understanding how we can best provide care and overdose services and harm reduction services for them.
Northern and Indigenous communities have been disproportionately impacted by this crisis, and so what does a culturally appropriate and regionally effective response actually look like on the ground here in the North from your perspective?
It means, you know, working with our Indigenous partners like First Nations Health Authority and our Indigenous health team at Northern Health to ensure that we are providing culturally safe and appropriate services. And we, you know, continue to work very closely with these teams to ensure that services are appropriate.
So Dr. Kling, after 10 years of a public health emergency, do you think that BC is still treating this as an emergency, or do you feel like it's almost become normalized? And if so, what needs to change in the next decade to truly turn that tide?
I think people are still recognizing this is an emergency, but I think doing things like this and recognizing the 10-year crisis, the 10-year anniversary of the drug crisis and drug emergency, I think it's really important just to keep people aware that, you know, for example, our rates in Northern Health, while they might be decreasing, they're still the highest rates of deaths in all of the province. And just keeping facts and statistics like that top of mind, I think is important in keeping keeping people aware and engaged in what's going on with the drug crisis. You know, focusing on preventing deaths in the moment, improving access to care, and changing systems and conditions that increase the risk, like stigma and barriers to care. You know, those are important next steps that we're focusing on in Northern Health to address this crisis.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
No problem. Thanks so much.
Ah, the sound of spring. The sandhill cranes are soaring in the thermals above us right now, trumpeting their call and alerting everyone in the Skeena region to stop and look up. These beautiful cranes are among the largest of North American birds, standing over 1 meter tall, and they have a wingspan of about 2 meters. What makes the sandhill crane unique is that they are ancient birds. Over thousands of years, they've evolved elaborate courtship rituals and a wide array of vocalizations. The flight behavior of cranes differs from that of swans and geese. During migration, which is largely by day, and during sunny weather, flocks of a few to several hundred birds frequently spiral upward on thermal updrafts, glide or flap for a distance, then spiral upward again. When flying in straight lines, they use a V formation, and distances between rest stops average about 250 kilometers, while their flight speeds range from 20 to 80 kilometers per hour, depending on wind speed and direction. The crane's snapping upstroke and slower downstroke distinguishes them from other long-legged, long-necked birds. Here in British Columbia, we usually see these cranes only during migration. Often, we're first alerted to the presence of these flocks flying high overhead by the sound of their 7 to 20 note loud rattle calls, sometimes referred to as a trumpeting or bugling, which have a rising or falling inflection when the birds are in flight. The age-old crane migrations through our province follow the same routes, use the same rest stops, and occur at the same time each year. Right now, we are lucky enough to enjoy the call of the sandhill cranes. And today I'm speaking with a wildlife biologist, Sean Sharp, for a little bit of information about the anatomy of these birds, the uniqueness of their call, and also best places to see them in the Buckley Valley.
Hi, well, my name is Sean Sharp, and I'm a biologist, wildlife biologist, and I've been living in the Smithers area on and off since about 1995. And worked at a whole range of things, everything from for the provincial government through private consulting, which I do these days.
Now, we're talking about sandhill cranes today, which I'm very excited about. And we seem to start to see them around, you know, like early to mid-April. What part of their migratory journey are we catching them at?
They're one of the bigger, more obvious migratory flocks of birds that we see. And they spend their winters down in sort of Texas and Mexico and some of the southern states. And they come all the way right up to the Northwest Territories from here and all across Canada and even into Siberia. So they have quite a journey. And they tend to come about the time that the wetlands are opening up in the north. So they start just at the edge of things. Like if you go about 2 hours north of here, there's still not much open water. It's mostly frozen. So they're kind of pushing the envelope, if you like, most years.
Typically, how many would we see passing over us in Smithers?
In Smithers area, we could see tens of thousands. You know, in flocks just a few days ago, there were well over 1,000 birds in the flock. And it's interesting because the flocks are usually collections of families, like the young birds from last year hang out with the parent birds right up until they reach their migratory grounds for the summer, and then they split up. And but they often don't, the young ones don't breed for probably 5 to 7 years after. So they're not, they don't breed the next year. They're not like some of these smaller birds.
So what's the typical lifespan of a sandhill crane?
They're a long-lived bird. The oldest one, I think, was about 37 years old.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a, you know, it's kind of a neat bird that way. They, you know, like Canada geese, they mate for life. you know, they're the pairs stick together for a long time, and if one dies, they will remate. But they make this journey every year for most of their lives, and the biggest threat they seem to face really is just wetland habitat, both here and in the south. So they were endangered and quite threatened in the 60s, but have recovered significantly. And I think the last estimate I saw is they were increasing about 4% per year.
Wow. Have there been noticeable changes in their patterns or their locations due to climate change?
Due to climate change, I think the thing about climate change is it's the variability. So as we get these really variable springs and falls, like more storms, colder spring temperatures, it can definitely influence them. But I don't think there's been any demonstrated effect on these birds yet, because they tend to come up with the major warm fronts that are pushing up from the south. And that's why we see them kind of squeezed into these couple of weeks, as we've had some nice warm air pushing up from the south and sunnier days and things like that. And so that they kind of do the timing of the migration with that. But spring conditions, if they're really variable and you get sudden snowstorms coming later than usual, you know, that can definitely put extra stress on them for sure. Mm-hmm. And in the south, of course, it's probably the opposite effects, you know, hotter than usual temperatures causing, you know, heat stress and drying up swamps and various things like that.
Yeah. When I hear their call, I'm like, I can hear it from inside my house without the windows open. So that beautiful trumpeting sound, is that one of the louder bird calls, or is there something special about their anatomy that allows the sound to travel so clearly?
Yeah, actually, they do have kind of a neat anatomy. Their trachea, like the wind, the pipe that lets the air in, basically, mm-hmm. they have an extra long one that actually can distend into the stomach region a bit, and it lets them get sort of that deeper resonance, and they even get some kind of harmonics and overtones, and that's part of the really spooky sound of their call. But it's a neat bird that way.
Yeah.
They're most known, actually. I mean, people have I don't know if you've ever seen them you know, on the ground and when they're mating, that, but they do this incredible dance. Like, they jump around and dance and really kind of neat. Their, you know, wings flapping and their heads pumping up and down, and very energetic looking.
Oh, that's really cool. Where would they typically mate?
Basically, they mate all across North America in the north, so all of northern Canada, and most every province, I think. Can't remember if they're in all of the eastern. Yeah, I've seen them in Nova Scotia, so they go right through. And then right up into the Northwest Territories, Nunavut, and the Yukon.
If you wanted to spot them, where would be a good place to sit and wait to see them landed, not necessarily flying?
Mm-hmm. Well, the spot where most of us have always kind of headed up to watch them is up the Kispiox Valley, just various, some of the farmlands and pasture lands through that area. They tend to settle down in there as a big stopover. Occasionally, even here, I've seen them just west, just sort of off of the fields as you head out of town heading west. But the most reliable place seems to be up the Kispiox Valley, a few of the big farms. And if you watch them in the evenings, they do these big spirals on the thermals in front of the mountains and then often kind of descend into the fields nearby just to rest.
Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to, then maybe up the Kispiox Valley and around like dusk is when you might be able to see them eating and maybe watering and resting.
Yeah, usually before it gets dark. They're coming down well before it's dark. Mm-hmm. When it starts to cool off, they don't have the thermals anymore, so they tend to drop down and settle in for the night.
Yeah, they're smart. They're high efficiency birds. They're like the Teslas of birds. What's the coolest fact or your favorite thing about sandhill cranes?
Yeah, I just think they're such a harbinger of spring. I mean, the fact that, you know, when you hear that sound, you know, spring is here. It's not going to be much longer that we have to wait in the snow and the cold. Yeah, and it's just neat because they often have mixed flocks too. So we see a bunch of other things flying with them, like snow geese And, you know, even occasionally swans will be mixed in with the big flocks that are flying overhead. So it really is like, oh, the gate is burst. They're heading north.
Before I go, is there anything that I didn't ask that you think is important for people to know?
I guess just you asked earlier about the climate change concerns. And I think that plus the habitat change, you know, just the importance of wetlands and having these areas that the birds can winter and the fact that we have to look after them over their whole range, not just one area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they're not alone. There's so many other birds that, you know, use the same habitats, and the more we can kind of minimize our impacts on climate change and keep the habitat that we have, the better things are for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And us, yeah, everyone, all of the things. Okay. Thank you so much, Sean, for speaking with me today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
If you've ever thought about getting your nails done for a fraction of the usual price, and maybe walking away with a story or two, there's a unique opportunity happening right here in Coast Mountain College Smithers. A small group of students, ranging from high schoolers as young as 15 to adult learners, are currently training in the college's Nail Technician Certificate Program, and they're looking for real people to practice on. Now, here's the catch. You'll need a little patience. These are students honing their craft, so appointments can take longer than your typical salon visit. But in exchange, you'll get affordable nail art and a front row seat to the next generation of nail techs, learning everything from acrylics and gel to client care and even business planning. The public can book appointments during select daytime hours throughout the week. Yesterday, I stopped in to chat with the nail techs, as well as the regional contracts officer and course instructor.
Hi there, my name is Lori Lynn Callio. I'm regional contracts officer for Coast Mountain College based at the Smithers campus. Yes, so we have 6 students, mainly from the Smithers and surrounding area, taking part in our nail technician program here at the Smithers campus. And we are encouraging members of the public to come by so that they can take part in experiential place-based learning. So people who are coming in to get their nails done will need to have a little bit more patience because they're still learning. Mm-hmm. And it may take longer for them to do a procedure than maybe it would at a salon where they're experienced and have done it many, many times. We're open certain hours of the day, so typically Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday from 9:30 in the morning till noon, and then in the afternoon from 1 to about 2:45 p.m., Fridays 1 to 2:45, so they try and be somewhat accommodating. So with this course, upon successful completion, students will be prepared to write the BC Beauty Council licensing exam. Mm-hmm. So that's something that they would do later after they take this course, and then they could go on and they could either work for an existing salon or potentially open their own salon. With this particular group or cohort, we do have a number of students from Smithers Secondary School taking the program. It's actually running full-time from February 2nd to June 5th, and it's our Nail Technician Certificate Program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Oh, I'm Izzy.
So this week is Nail Art Week. Is this the most exciting? Like, do you like doing this stuff? Do you like doing the business plan more?
Yeah. No, this is way better than the business plan. Don't tell Dawn, but it is way better. I did a flower with nail foils. And then I tried to do chrome, but it didn't really work. So we're going to have to try that again. And then we'll do rhinestones on this one. And then I actually don't know what the plan is for the last two.
And so are you a recent high school graduate or?
No, I'm in high school. I'm in grade 10 this year.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. So what inspired you to do this and high school at the same time?
Well, I've done nails like all my life. Like I've done nail polish, and then I've been doing it for the past 2 years. And then I saw the opportunity come up at the high school and I was like, oh my God, that'd be so cool. But like my age was a bit of a factor. So I didn't really think it was going to work out, but then all the pieces kind of fell together and they made an exception for me, which I was really grateful for.
Because what, you had to be 16 to enter this?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, I feel like the semester was hard enough because I had all my academics to get that out of the way. Oh, so it was a bit of a push, but it was worth it.
My name's Amber Lee.
What grade are you in?
12.
What did it take to get into this nail tech course?
So we had to do like an interview, and then there was like a work safety quiz that you had to do.
What was the interview like? Did it feel like a job interview, or what did it feel like?
Yeah, it kind of felt like a job interview. They were just, like, asking me questions, and, like, it was because, like, this course is, like, one of the most expensive courses that they offer. They're trying to be diligent about that, but also offer to kids what they want to do.
And what's your goal? Do you want to own your own business after this? Do you want to work in a spa for some experience?
I'll probably work in a salon for a bit to get more experience. Mm-hmm. I think I really want to do, like, a mobile nail service on, like, the rodeo circuit.
Do a what?
A mobile nail service on the rodeo circuit.
Like, are you also part, like, are you involved with rodeo else?
Yeah.
Okay, what else do you do then?
I just do barrel racing.
Oh, very cool. So, yeah. Well, that would be a great idea.
Well, I also, like, a lot of barrel racers like to get their nails done, but, like, they're traveling every single weekend, so it's... In my head, it's probably a little bit hard for them to make these appointments and to get them done when they're constantly traveling. So I'm like,
That's a
two-in-one. When they're not racing, they can get this done, but also not have to, like, travel or, like, oh, I'm being called. I gotta go.
Yeah.
Like,
Dawn Hall. So I'm the instructor of the nail technology course here in Smithers. So I teach this course and the aesthetics course for Coast Mountain College.
Because it's an audio format, explain where we are and what we're doing.
We are in the shop at Coast Mountain College where they teach the carpentry.
So, Dot, what are kind of like the secret skills that people don't know that they're going to take away from this course?
You know what? I think it's really important that if you're going to get your nails or your feet done, especially if you have an immune compromised system, you want to make sure you're finding somebody who is actually certified. So it's really important, and that's my big goal, is making sure these girls all leave here confident enough to get out there and work in the work world.
Yeah.
Professionally.
Do you have to teach your students ever how to have small talk?
Absolutely. They have to learn client consultations, and they have to learn how to interact with it. So they have the four C's. What are the four C's, girls?
Connect, consult, create, and
nice. So this is kind of a funny thing that I don't know a lot of people in town know about, which is that this is an open spa for students.
Yeah.
What would you suggest for people who are hearing about this and think, well, I want to get a manicure for $15?
Everybody wants to get a manicure, pedicure, but I highly recommend taking it a step further. Come in and challenge their skills on tips and overlays or sculpt, like with forms, because that's where they really need lots of practice. It's cheap. You're never going to get that price anywhere else. And if you are getting that price somewhere else, they're probably not professional yet.
What else should people know about this program?
They also have to do a business project. So with the business project, they should be able at the end of it, when their project is done, to walk into any bank or financial institution, be able to present it as a business plan, and hopefully walk out with the funding they need to start their own business.
Okay, thank you, Dawn.
Yeah.
My name's Emerson.
Okay. Are you in high school as well?
Yeah, I'm in grade 12 right now.
So how do you find balancing your school, this course, and then also like the big project for writing a business plan?
I actually have my high school credits completed, so then I got that done first semester, and now second semester I'm fully doing this, so it's not too much work, and I got that balanced pretty well.
Yeah, very nice.
Do you want to own your own business after this?
I do want to own my own business, yeah. I'm super excited.
Rock on. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mackenzie McGrath.
What skills are you learning?
We're learning how to apply gel and acrylic and extensions, and how to balance our gels and acrylic so that they have a good apex, so that they don't break or damage the natural nail.
What are any sort of those skills that you didn't anticipate to learn in this course that you've taken? Like, how is your small talk? Is it good?
Yeah, it's decent. I kind of just let the convo flow. Like, in class, we're taught to engage with the conversation but continue working and not look up very often, and just, like, just really let them talk because it's their time and not our time. Mm-hmm. So we listen to their stories and ask questions if we see fit, and just kind of let it flow. Yeah, that's what a nail tech is. We're here to beautify and make your day feel better. Just let it all out. Free therapy-ish.
Free therapy. Not a licensed therapist.
Okay, thanks, Mackenzie.
I'm Malaya Berendrecht.
Okay, what are you doing here? This looks technical.
I'm applying rhinestones to the nail.
What's your project? Like, is your final project, is it a business plan to own your own business?
It's more like, it can be your own business, but it's more hypothetical, I'd say, because I, for starters, do not have 40 grand to start a business.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
But do you have the business plan to ask a bank for 40 grand?
I'm working on that.
Get it, girl.
I'm working on it.
Okay. And what grade are you in?
11.
Okay, very nice. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're interested in booking an appointment and supporting these students as they build their skills, the public clinic at Coast Mountain College Smithers is open Tuesday through Thursday mornings and early afternoons, or you can visit coastmountaincollege.ca. And just a reminder, bring a little extra time and maybe a bit of curiosity. You may leave with a fresh set of nails and a newfound appreciation for the work that goes into them. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.